And we just analyze things. In other words, we split them into parts. When we split them into parts, we find out there's nothing substantial there. That's the whole thing, to understand that matter, earth, air, fire and water, there's nothing substantial in this thing you call the body. It's just a coming together of elements, a few atoms coming together, a few quarks arranging themselves in certain ways, and that's you. So when you say who you are, just an arrangement of quarks. That's modern science. So amazing how many different ways we can arrange three quarks. So apparently that's all there is, three quarks. And from just three quarks, we get Singaporeans, we got Malaysians, we get Indonesians, we get Sri Lankans, we get Australians, we get everybody. Just men and women, just from three quarks. And also we get elephants, we get animals, insects, all coming from the three quarks. So we do that just as a way of just analyzing. But there's another method of the four element meditation. I'm not sure if you know that was taught by Sariputta to the Buddha's son Rahula. And it's a great meditation to do. He said, just like you start with the earth, say, people can defecate on earth. They can urinate on earth. They can vomit upon earth. But does the earth ever complain? No. The water can take all your excrement away. It can take rubbish away. But does the water ever complain? No. Same as the air and the fire can burn anything. The fire never complains. So you be like the earth. You be like the fire. You be like the water, the air. People can unload all their rubbish on you. They can call you an idiot. They can call you camel face. They can call you whatever they like. But you're just like the earth. You can plant flowers on the earth, or you can plant toxic waste dumps. And the earth is always equanimous. So the meditation on being the earth, being the fire, being the water, being the air, whatever happens to you, you don't move. You accept everything. Sloth and torpor, restlessness and remorse, sensory desire, ill will, doubt. You're like the earth. The earth doesn't move because the earth doesn't doubt. Don't go thinking. Just be like the earth. Silent, peaceful, unmoving. Those are the four element meditations. Easy. Any questions on that? No? Good. I've got to get on with things. I started late. Dear Ajahn, can you elaborate on the process of dying? What can we expect to see or hear, feel? In Sogyal Rinpoche's book, Tibetan Book of the Living and Dying, he describes the four stages of the dissolution of the body and the state of the bardos. Please give your comment. Thank you. What are we saying about being in the present moment? You're not dead yet. So, leave it alone till when it happens. But, now you've answered that question, I should answer it. That process of dying, it's a great start to this question. Because dying is a process. If you've ever been with someone who's dying, there's a few doctors here, they know this. You can never say at which point the person's actually dead. You notice when they start, they're alive. When they're finished, they're dead. But in between, it's just a slow process. A gradual decline in the life faculties. And you can't ever find this one point when they're really dead. Which is why some people, they're half alive and half dead. And you can't really understand exactly which is the most, more alive or more dead. And people in that state sometimes create great ethical problems for people. But for you, you are alive at the moment. So what's going to happen when you die? These four stages in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, that's only one possibility. The trouble with the Tibetan books over there, that they were written so long ago that no one challenges them. Just one possible way of dying. But there are many others as well. Some people don't even go through that. They just immediately they either go off into a new birth or they don't go anywhere at all. But what it will feel like to you is your body disappearing, your five senses turning off, and everything disappearing. Just like in the jhanas. And you go floating up outside of your body, being able to see and hear everything going on here. And if you're very lucky, you can go up to your best friend or your partner and go, "Ooh, ooh, this is me." Go and haunt someone. It's good fun. Well, you're a ghost for a few minutes after you die, so you might as well enjoy it. Go and find someone who doesn't believe in ghosts and go and say, "I told you so, I told you so." And so you go floating out of your body, and then people usually go and see this beautiful light. And what that light is, the senses are disappearing, that's your mind. And the interesting thing is, the strength, the brilliance of that light is directly proportional to your beauty, your virtue, your goodness, your spiritual qualities, which empower your mind. Which is why in this retreat, you are empowering your spiritual qualities. You're letting go, you're being silent, you're being keeping all these precepts. Your mind is getting more and more brilliant, more and more powerful. So if you die at the end of the retreat, it's the best time to die. Just when your mind is really powerful. Unfortunately, you're just too protected, so you can't really die at the end of the retreat. But if you did, it's really good luck. So this is what happens. And then you go off searching for a new life. Depends on where you want to get reborn. Where do you want to go? Now, a lot of times, people have fantasies. You are building up sort of the future rebirth which you like, which you want. This is what happens. And if you have that power, if you have the spiritual qualities called the good karma, and you want to go somewhere, then you get there. And sometimes, once you get there, you think, "What do I want to go here for?" But it's too late by then. A lot of people, they want to be reborn as human beings. And some people, they want to be reborn in these rich countries and be rich people. What stupid idiots they are. If you have a lot of money in your next life, you have a lot of headaches as well. I don't know if any of you have read Plato's Republic. There's a last chapter there was supposedly Plato's idea of rebirth. And he said there, well, after they've rested after the last life, they could actually choose what life they want. He said, all these stupid ones, they all become generals or leaders or famous people or rich people or sometimes poor people. They're the stupid ones. The really wise ones, they never want to be famous. They never want to be rich. They never want to be prominent. They never want to be poor either. Just in the middle where people leave you alone. You can be comfortable, but not prominent. That's too many people, they want to be famous. They want to be rich. They want to be the best. And that means they have lots of headaches. So the best person, the best life, is just the average life. The middle way. So, and the other thing which I was mentioning in a few talks I gave not so long ago, what about when you get reborn in the hell realm? Why do people get reborn in those hell realms? Isn't this rather mean of the Buddha to make hell realms? And of course the Buddha doesn't make hell realms. And it's not some god making hell realms. You make your hell realms. You construct them yourself. You think that's what you deserve because you've been mean and nasty. And you go to where you think you deserve to go. Interesting. In the Buddhist suttas, they have all these descriptions of hell realms. People being in vats of boiling oil, being poked by people. They have these great paintings on the temples in Thailand. In the days before you had horror movies, people would go to the temples and take their kids there and see all these gruesome things which were happening to people. But, was that real? People asked. Do such hell realms exist?
These are all mind-made states. If you understand the way of the mind and get into these jhanas and see just how the mind can create things and how powerful it is, it creates what you think you deserve. You aren't being boiled in vats of boiling liquid in these hell realms or poked, but that's the way you'll describe it. So many years ago, there was one of the members of our society, some of you might know him. He had a very, very bad back. So bad that he was under this pain clinic in Osborne Park Hospital. And when he had developed actually amazingly good meditation, because his pain was so great, so intense, that he had to really sort of meditate and just let go. Because I remember him coming up to me one day, and he said with a big smile, "I've finally done it." And that's interesting. What have you done? And he said, "I finally got the machine, the monitor, flat." I said, "Oh, the ECG. You know, your heart rate flat." He said, "That was easy. I've got the EEG flat now." He said he could meditate. And when they're putting this brain scan on him, just because of his skill in meditation, he can make it absolutely flat. And he turned around into, this was actually before the time we had our Dhamma hall, it was in the community hall. He turned around on a Friday night, or even could be a Saturday afternoon, I think. He said, "See all those people in the back? There's all the doctors and nurses from the hospital. They're trying to figure out what the hell's going on." And I believed him. But, in particular, his pain was so great that in the hospital, they devised a way that he could explain it to his friends and relations. Because how can you say, "Oh, it hurts"? And then, "Yeah, I've got a headache, it hurts as well." "Oh, but mine really hurts." "Yeah, so does mine." How can you actually quantify pain? And so they did give a scale of pain. They could see it on the machines, that the areas of pain were just really just throbbing with energy, with pain energy. And they could actually equate it. And they had these different scales of pain. And they use metaphors from daily life. And he said, "My metaphor, the way I describe the pain I'm feeling constantly," he said, "it's the same pain, the same intensity, as if you're having your arm sawn off with a saw." Because I know what that pain feels like. And that was his equivalent. It gave him a way of explaining what he was experiencing. Not just a little headache, not just an itch, but intense pain. And when he actually said that, many lights went on in my mind and said, "Ah, this is actually what the hell realms are like. This is just a way of explaining the sort of the pain and suffering which you put on yourself in those hell realms. It's not you're being boiled in oil, but that's what it's like. That's the intensity of the suffering." Now you can understand what those hell realms are. These are just intense suffering, and these are just metaphors to describe it as much to yourself as to others. And why does that happen? Because you think you deserve it. Your guilt forces you to go into such great pain. And if ever you've actually hurt someone and felt so guilty and felt the suffering, the immense mental agony of guilt, that's what happens. You put yourself in that terrible state. But you could absolve yourself from hell at any time. The gates of hell are always open if you can only forgive yourself and let go. This is what happens to you when you die. If you do not know about letting go and forgiveness and letting go of the past. I said, "I can't let go of the past. What I've done, I can't let it go." Yes, you can. If you've got the guts, the wisdom, the courage to let go of the past, to forgive, learn and walk on. However, many of us, when we've done something bad, that dung, that poo, we just carry around with us, and that is our hell. So this is what happens to you when you die. If you learn some Dhamma, learn how to let go, to forgive, to love, to accept, especially to let go of the past, the hell realms will never be your destination. If you know how to appreciate this moment, to find fun in this moment, even in a moment of death, and have so much happiness and joy, your mind will create the heaven for you. and there you'll be in the heaven realms. It's up to you. These are mental created realms, mind-made bodies, mind-made realms. So where do you want to go? Where do you think you deserve to go? That's where you'll end up. Fascinating. Any questions about that? That's going to be in Ajahn Brahm's Book of Dying one day. Dear Ajahn, can you provide some tips for walking meditation, please? I find it difficult to attain any level of attention. Okay, with walking meditation, you choose a path, maybe about 15, 20 paces long, maybe a bit longer if you want to. You choose the path. If you can't go between two trees, then put, say, you know, one slipper down on one end, one slipper down on the other end, and you walk from one place to the other, just walking backwards and forwards, walking backwards and forwards, walking backwards and forwards. So you make a simple path so it's not complicated. You don't have to think about where you're going. You just go to the end, you turn around, come back again. What could be more simple than that? People like complications in life, though. And you put your attention, you keep your eyes open, 2 meters in front of you so you can see if there's any sticks or anything in the way. And you walk to the end, you turn around and walk back again. The first stage of walking meditation is present moment awareness. So let go of all the past, all the places you've come from. Let go of the future, all the destinations in front of you. So the only thing you have is this present moment, that's all. So you're walking in the moment. No past, no future. Now stage number two, as you get into the quietness of the moment, you get the silence. You're silent present moment awareness. So you're just walking, you're not thinking. You're not giving it a name. You're feeling, experiencing, receiving the information of the moment. Not making any comments about it as you walk backwards and forwards. And once you have present moment awareness and silence, then you focus on the movement of your feet. Feel what it's like when your left foot is on the grass. What is it like, skin on grass? You feel the foot move up from the grass as it flows through the air and falls onto the grass. What part of the foot touches the grass first? What last? You feel the sensations of the foot as it presses against the grass and feels the ground underneath. One step. And then you do your next step. Always in the moment, just watching the movement of the feet. And as your mindfulness increases, because you're not doing very much, you're keeping it simple. Just all of these stages, they open up and they become so brilliant and so peaceful and so beautiful. Just one step just occupies such huge amount of time. You just tend to go slowly. Once when I was doing walking meditation I'd just been newly ordained as a monk in the temple in Thailand. After the chanting in the morning, I would do a walking meditation for 1 hour. The hall was maybe a little bit longer than this room, but it took me half an hour to get from one end to the next. Another half an hour to get back again. Because a big grandfather clock would chime every quarter of an hour and take at least 4 chimes to get back to where I started. I used to get so quiet and so peaceful that once I was getting right into it, just as I was getting into meditation and 10 minutes late for the questions and answers this evening, I was getting so into it that I forgot there was a dana I had to go, a ceremony. And they sent a monk to go and get me. And the monk came up to me and said, Brahma Wangso, Brahma Wangso. And what I heard was, Brahma Wangso. So distant, I heard it. And he had to say it again. Brahma Wangso. It was like 100 miles away as it called my attention. And I realized it was a monk. And I had to move to look at him. And it took about 3 or 4 minutes. I'm going really fast now as I'm turning my head. I couldn't go fast. I couldn't do it fast. I was trying my best. And when I saw him, I said, pardon? You just can't move fast when you get still and quiet. You just go really slowly, really slowly. And it gets really great fun. However, some people think you're crazy doing walking meditation. When our monks first went to England, they had a hard time actually holding any retreats, but they had a disciple who was, she was a clinical psychiatrist, and she got this big house in a village not far away from Chithurst. And so she offered it to them. She said, look, there's plenty of accommodation. We've got a big barn over here. We'll have a meditation retreat in my house. We went very well until they started doing the walking meditation in the garden. Now, this was a typical English village. And, of course, a few people just, always very nosy, saying, what's going on here? And one of the villagers, looked into this garden and saw all these people, like zombies, walking backwards and forwards, really slowly. And they knew the owner of this house was a psychiatrist who worked at the local mental home. They put two and two together and they called the police. Hey, she's taken all her patients into her garden. And the police turned up at this meditation retreat to return everybody back to the mental home. It actually happened. They had to explain. They're not patients, they're just meditators. Because sometimes it looks a bit strange when you do things like that. So that's actually how you do the walking meditation. Do it slowly. You get into very nice, beautiful, peaceful states. It's good fun. Any questions on that one? Okay, the next question. I would appreciate comments on dealing with mental formations which are not helpful. I'd appreciate comment on dealing with mental formations which are not helpful, I think. Okay, any mental formations, just throw them all away. Don't form any mental formations. So just allow all the mental stuff to unform, to scatter, just to disappear. Because all the mental formations, why do we form these things? Why do we think? You do the thinking. You are responsible. I know sometimes people say they're meditating, a thought just comes from nowhere. No, it doesn't. You go fishing for it. You're fishing for it over here, fishing for it over here, anything to think about, because you get bored, and that's why you think. Thoughts do not pop up uninvited. You go seeking for them. They just come in, and you grab hold of them, and there they are. So, the thing is, just get sort of fed up with thinking. You've been thinking all your life, for goodness sake. Where has it ever got you? It just gets you headaches, it gets you upset. It gets you into desire, it gets you into ill will and anger. You start thinking about this terrible thing which happened to you and the terrible person who did it to you. You think, and you get yourself in a terrible state. It'd be wonderful just to let it all go. So you can listen to life. You don't need to get a theory about it. You just know it. Just be peaceful and silent. One of my great heroes, he was a monk who could hardly think at all. When he went to school in grade one, he was so peaceful, they thought he was stupid. After the first year in grade one in the school in Thailand, the teacher just could not pass him, so told him to do the year again. Grade one, plasticine. Whatever else they do, he could pass plasticine. Whatever else they do in grade one, I don't know what they do in grade one these days, but he could pass. So he did it again. He had to repeat the year. After the second year, even with the best will in the world, he said, look, I just cannot pass you. I cannot send you up to grade two. So he had to repeat it a third year. And after 3 years, no progress. So it was a waste of time. So he had to leave school. And when he left school, after 3 years of grade one, couldn't pass grade one. Then they didn't know what to do with him. They thought he was too stupid to become a farmer. So they did the only thing they could do. They ordained him as a monk. What they do in Thailand. It's a repository for everybody. And he went to this monastery, and the abbot was just so kind and so patient, who tried to teach him a bit of chanting and a bit of Buddhism and even a bit of the Thai language. But the Abbot, even though he's so patient and so kind, spent hours with this young boy, couldn't get anywhere with him. He was just that thick, so it seemed. And so as a last resort, he sent this young man to a forest monastery. Not all forest monks are forest monks because of that. But this one was. And they sent him to this forest monastery. And the abbot there just told him, okay, just watch the breath. And it was easy for him. He just watched the breath going in, watched the breath going out. He soon got into jhana, soon he was enlightened. He had a great old time. Because his mind was just so pure and so simple. He just didn't think about anything. Easy to become enlightened. So all you people have just been really ruined and spoilt by the education system. You've been taught to think. And really you should go and sue the education department for stopping your enlightenment. So just let go of all the thinking. This creates too much problem for you. Next question. Are sounds useful as a meditation object? For example, the wind, the ocean, or bird song, or are they just distractions? You can start with a simple sound, but the most important part of that sound, make sure the presentness of the sound is happening now. Just make that the most important point. It's a sound which is experiencing now. And then that nowness will become the most important thing. And then you can go into the silence, because silence is the best sound of all, when all the sounds disappear and nothing is left. And the whole universe stops. Even the birds don't open their beaks. Nothing moves. It's the best sound of all. Remember once, again, when I was visiting this monastery in Sussex, in the winter time, that time they still hadn't put in the central heating. And that night it was minus 26 degrees. Was it Fahrenheit or centigrade? It doesn't really matter, that's cold enough anyway. Really cold. One of the monks would make themselves a cup of tea. Boiling water, they'd go to the toilet. By the time they came back, it was iced tea, a block of ice. It was that cold. I saw in the newspapers the following morning. The headlines were, even the beer froze. The British beer, that's all they care about is beer. And tea. And the next morning I decided to go walk in the forest. And it was amazing. Everything was so still. Nothing was moving. It was magical in the forest after a heavy snowfall in northern Europe in the early morning. It was so silent. I loved that. That was magic. It was sacred. Silence is the most holy thing. In parts of Australia, you can go out into the bush. You don't hear anything. Absolutely still. That's the best sound of all. Because it just makes the mind still. And everything stops. Even your mind. So listen to. Next question. Dear Ajahn Brahm, I would like some guided metta bhavana practice. I don't know how others feel, but I'm sure John Howard would benefit. Is this practicable? Okay, loving kindness is coming later. It's on the menu later on during this retreat. But if you want to do some now, you know how to do loving kindness meditation. The door of my heart is open to this moment. Whatever's happening now, give love, metta, acceptance to this very moment in front of you. Radiate it with energy. Not a being, because this moment is like a being. It's here. And if you give loving kindness this moment is like smiling at the moment, and the moment smiles back at you. And you're just here. And you give this moment not ill will, you give this moment acceptance, warmth, and everything stops again in the beauty and the radiance of metta in the moment. Next question. I have a lot of chicky thoughts during my meditation practice. What should I do? What's chicky thoughts? Is that cheeky thoughts or is it chicken thoughts? Or is that chick thoughts, like with girls? I don't know what that is. Chicky thoughts. It must be cheeky thoughts, I think, probably. Cheeky thoughts. Okay. If you have a cheeky thought, laugh. And get it over and done with, and then shut up. Because it's good to give yourself a bit of play in a meditation. So you've got lots of time, so you can waste a bit of time if it's a cheeky thought, you get an interesting thought, and you can follow it and laugh, and then you forget about it, and go back onto silence. So sometimes it's okay to play with the mind a bit. So don't be too serious when you're meditating. If you're too serious, you're too hard, you haven't got that softness, that beauty, that joy, that sense of play, which is so important in the meditation, because play makes it interesting. So when you're watching the breath, you just play with it. You enjoy it. I've already told you about breathing backwards and making a bit of fun about the breath. When you, I learned this as a school teacher. If you make the lesson interesting and you make sort of even the math lesson a bit of play, then the kids get involved. And they really listen and they learn a lot when it's play. But if you make it really serious, people turn off. So you make it a bit of fun. You make it a bit of fun, a bit of play in your meditation. The mind gets engaged, you get happiness, concentration, it all comes together. So play with your meditation. Don't be too serious. Give it some interest, some joy, and it proceeds very, very, very well. Next question. If meditation improves one's family ties, how does it help in one's business? Very easy. Because once you get the psychic powers, because you've got a very strong mind, you can actually see where the stock market's going. Isn't that great? That is one guy, I'm not joking, one guy used to do this. He was a Thai Buddhist and came from a very good family. I know him. He gave some big donations to Chittas Monastery in the early years. He had some psychic powers and he could actually predict the stock market and made a fortune for himself. Didn't need to work at all. And then afterwards he went to work for the Queen of Thailand. So, can be done. But of course, the Buddhist Society asked for 10% of any. Well, we gave you all the instructions and taught you how to do it. Is it true to say that by letting go of everything in meditation, you actually get everything in meditation? Thank you, a businessman. Yeah, it's true. If you let go of everything in meditation, you get everything in meditation, you get all this peace, you get this energy, you get this clarity. And there's lots of business people who practice their meditation to clear their mind, to make it nice and strong and peaceful, so they're alert. This is one guy I read about. He goes to all these big deals in New York. And that's what he does all day, just go to meetings and making deals. And he says he never gets into a car or a limo or anything. He actually walks from block to block, because it's all in there, pretty close together, all the big places. And he walks from block to block, but he does walking meditation as he goes from meeting to meeting. So when he's actually left one big sort of block, business condo or whatever, he walks mindfully in the present moment, relaxing, not thinking about anything, letting go. So when he gets to the next appointment, he's clear, he's rested, he's sharp. That's why he does very well. Because you'll find when you let the mind be peaceful for a few minutes, you get the energies coming up, you're sharp, and sometimes you get some intuition coming, you can second guess what the other people are thinking about. You can actually almost read their minds. The great thing that will be in business, to read the minds of your competitors. Who knows, you might be able to do that. So it's great in business. At the very least, your sharpness, your clarity, means you don't make so many mistakes. Next question. To Ajahn Brahm, the superpower mindfulness you spoke about this morning seems very lofty. How long will one need to meditate, practice mindfulness, to reach those states? Especially poor me, who hasn't got such traits. You have got such traits. Your superpower mindfulness is just waiting there, waiting for an opportunity. It's building up right now. I gave this simile this morning in the interviews. It's an old simile which I learned from my first meditation teacher about patience. When he was a young boy in Bangkok, his father gave him some seeds and he planted them in the ground. And nothing happened. Even though he watered them every morning, he could see no progress. And he thought, what a waste of time. His father told him, seeds, they're germinating, they're growing underneath. They're probably growing right at this moment, but they're under the ground, you can't see them. But I assure you, they're growing. Keep on watering. In a couple of days, you might see something. And so he carried on watering. In a couple of days, his father was right. He saw these little seeds, these little bits of green, just poking up above the surface of the dirt. And he was so excited, he watered his little plants twice a day. And they grew, and they grew, and they grew. When about 2 inches tall, he lost his patience. He decided to stretch them to make them grow faster. And he killed every one. But he learned a great lesson. You cannot stretch plants. No more can you stretch your mind to try and make these things happen quickly. But, just like those seeds are growing under the surface, you may not be seeing superpower mindfulness growing, but it is growing there. The less you do, the more powerful it's coming. It's coming. It's happening. One day you'll burst forth, and there you've got superpower mindfulness. When you're least expecting it, you'll have a beautiful meditation. This happens. People get into these deep meditations when they least expect it. They think, oh, not me. But it happens to you. Always happens to a few people in these meditation retreats, and the ones who least expect it. It could be you this time. Isn't that wonderful? So yeah, don't worry about it. You're getting there. It's not that lofty. Then actually, I was unable to register fully this morning's Dharma talk. Would you please summarize it? Thank you. Yeah, this morning's Dharma talk was on mindfulness, and on the superpower mindfulness. How when you do little, all the energy goes into knowing. You're not thinking. Thinking wastes energy. You're not managing, fault-finding, complaining. You're being content in the moment. Every moment, a moment of peace. Every opportunity for contentment, you give contentment. Happy to be in this moment, no matter what it is. Because the mind isn't moving, the energy builds up. Like the water coming behind a dam. It builds and builds and builds until it gets this enormous power. In that not doing things, all the energy goes into bare mindfulness. And you become more awake, more alert, more alive. And then one day, that water gets so strong, it bursts out the dam. And you get superpower mindfulness. You go and say, wow, this is amazing. Wow, this is so beautiful. Wow, this happened. It does. So it's just a matter of time. The water is building up. Soon it's going to rush over the dam. And there, you get superpower mindfulness. And it gets fun. It's one of the great joys of a meditation retreat when these things happen. When you start to see things glisten, you start to see into things you've never thought were there before. You understand the power of the mind. When you give it the energy. And also, after a while, you understand how psychic powers happen. When you see a little bit of energy like that, and how your mind could be energized, you can understand when you really get into these jhanas business, do it many, many times, just how powerful your mind can become. And what sort of things it can do. So those of you who come from Singapore, maybe you may not need to get in the plane. Maybe you can fly under your own devices. But remember, we're always landing in Changi, don't land anywhere else. And report to the customs. And when they have to put in the customs form, where did you come? What flight? You say, yeah, you say, Jada Air. As above, is it okay to smile at each other along the corridors instead of staying in a glum face and ignoring you? It would be more pleasant indeed
After all, you smile a lot. Yeah, go on, you can smile. So if you see anybody glum, you don't talk to them. Don't beg into speech, but you can always go... Make faces at each other. Make stupid faces. It brings a lot of fun and happiness into the meditation. And that happiness is, you know, energizes the mind again. That's why I don't just tell jokes because of being just for facetious. I do this on purpose. Because it makes people happy, it brings them energy, engages them, you get more power. And especially in the retreat, a little bit of entertainment of an evening or a morning really gets you going and improves your meditation. That's why an enlightened person is called a ha-ha-ha-harahat. They laugh a lot. I get in trouble for that one. Okay. Okay. Someone didn't like the meditation retreat. Said, meditation retreats are not for me. I'm out of here. Sorry for any inconvenience. So someone has left. Never mind. Hope you enjoy yourself. Look around, who is it? Ajahn, mindfulness in appreciating beauty. Indulgence in sensory gratification through beauty. How to distinguish between them? Okay, there's a beauty which is born of letting go. And there's a beauty or the pleasure which is born of attaching to things. And you know the difference between the two of them. Because one is like a natural beauty which lasts, which is like fundamental. And the other one is something which is ephemeral, just comes and goes, doesn't really last at all. So it's that pleasure from the sensory world. It comes and it goes and it disappears very quickly. But there's something underlying the beauty, like the beauty of nature, for example. That lasts a long time. It's not like the beauty of like a mango. You know, you can taste the mango, a couple of seconds it's gone. But you can watch a flower. Or you can watch the moon, and it lasts a long time. It's those beauties which last a long time, which are fundamental, which are underlying things. They're the ones which we can focus on. Especially the beauty of silence, the beauty of letting go, the beauty of the mind. This is that they call, the Buddha said you should learn how to distinguish between the pleasures. There's the pleasures which lead to more suffering, and there's the pleasures which lead to the end of suffering, to freedom. And I think you can understand the difference between those types of pleasures. The pleasures of watching the TV, the pleasures of, say, getting into sport. And I couldn't believe it, just the way people used to get into soccer in my home country in England when I was young. I remember this one occasion when there was a World Cup qualifiers, and I was a school teacher at this time. I always remember this. England were playing Poland. And all they needed was a draw to qualify for the World Cup finals. And they were... I saw it on the TV. Everyone was talking about it in the school the night before. We all went home early to watch the soccer on the TV. And they were attacking. And they got hit the crossbar. The goalie made amazing saves. England was so unlucky. In the last few moments, before the finish of the game, Poland scored. England were out. Oh, it was so unlucky. It was only a game, I didn't care. But the following day, even the naughty kids were silent. No one was misbehaving. They were just so depressed and upset. The whole school was in mourning. It's crazy, it's only a soccer match. What's the big deal? But for them, it was just really, really important. And when you look at it, now, in like in these competitions, like, you know, like this World Cup, I think 32 teams go to this World Cup. One team come home happy. 31 teams have suffering. You've got a 31-1 chance of ending up coming back absolutely disappointed. And even if you get to the final, you're almost there, you're almost there. That's real suffering. And the one who does have a good time, only for about a week or two, then they forget about it afterwards. What a complete waste of time, following sport, or following all these competitions. So, a waste of time. I even like watching this cricket. We used to have two caretakers some years ago. And because it was a Saturday afternoon, there was this important one-day match, Australia versus someone or other. And so because they had to look after the monks, they put it on a videotape, on VCR. And they thought, after the monks, you know, we sent them back after the meditation, they're going to watch it together until 1 or 2 o'clock. And they were watching it and watching and watching it. And it was one of these really exciting matches. It came to the last ball. I think Australia did about 3 runs off the last ball to win. And then the VCR stopped. The tape finished at the last ball. And that was Jasper and what's his name?
Phil,
that's right, yeah. Jasper and Phil. And they deliberately not looked at the news because they didn't want to spoil their excitement. And by that time, they couldn't get the newspaper. They couldn't find out. They had to wait all night until the following morning to find out who'd won. Oh, what stupid suffering that was. So, just we make a lot of suffering for ourselves. So those pleasures of the senses, there's many of them. When we look at them, what are we doing that for? Absolutely ridiculous. Some people go to these movies. There's, I know, pardon me, book. She told me her mother, she's a Chinese Thai, used to love going to the Chinese movies. And in the Chinese movies, I don't know if they've changed, they're always the same plot. Boy meets girl, the family gets in the way. If not the family, the Imperial Chinese Army gets in the way. But anyway, someone gets in the way. And they almost make it together, but they never do. Someone gets killed, or the families sort of keep them apart. And it always ends in tragedy. And he said her mother would come home every Friday night, red-eyed, because she'd been crying her eyes out in the movie theater. He said, why do you do that? Why do you get so much suffering? You cry every time you go to watch a Chinese movie. Why don't you watch another movie? He said, oh, no, it's so nice. It's so wonderful to cry. He just loves suffering, that's all. I don't know why people do that. But is that still the case with Chinese movies? Still pretty much the same? You don't watch them. You're clever. So the point is, we have different happinesses to be found in the world. If we know what the real ones are, we can have real happiness, real joy, simple happinesses. And the most simple happiness of all is this happiness of letting go. Get more peace, more happiness to meditate than you can get from any other source. It is so peaceful, so blissful. You get this ultimate contentment, lasts for hours and hours and hours. Don't want to be anywhere else in the world, just in this moment. And that's peace, that's beauty, that's joy. So that's knowing the two different types of pleasure. And you go for the beautiful one. That's the best to go for. So, anyone got any questions about that? What time is it? Oh, it's just beautiful. The rain is coming. Yeah?
When you have a soup of mindfulness,
yeah.
You gave the example of staying in a very green grass.
Yep.
So, surely that's a pleasure.
Aha. It's a sensual pleasure, but it's a pleasure which is born of a letting go. So it can't attach to anything. As soon as you try attaching to it and grasping it, it all disappears. So that's why it's like a pure pleasure. It's the same as like the jhanas. People keep saying, oh, you get attached to these pleasures of jhanas. If you do get attached and you start grasping, they all disappear. They can't stay with such impure thoughts or impure mind states. So because of that, literally, you can't attach to them. If you do, they break, they disappear. And you've tried that before. Those of you who've got into reasonably peaceful states of meditation, when you try and grasp them and hold on to them, they all vanish. They're all born of letting go. That's why it's a pure state. That's why those are the pleasures, superpower mindfulness, which you do not need to be afraid of. You can indulge in and enjoy to your heart's content. So meditation retreats, they're not boring, they're not dull, they're not just pain, pain, pain. They're fun, fun, fun. That's why, when I went to give a retreat at Sydney once, The person driving me to this retreat had just been to Vipassana course before. And he told me it was just so much pain and so much suffering that he called the meditation hall the torture chamber. Every time he came to a meditation, he was going into the torture chamber again. And I say, in my retreats, we don't call it the torture chamber. We call it the entertainment center. So when you come into this hall, it's the entertainment center. The joy palace. We can come in here and sit down and experience this wonderful state of bliss and peace. And it's true. So real meditation is states of happiness. And if anybody doubts the veracity of that, I always quote one of the old Buddhist suttas. It's called the Dhammacetiya Sutta from the Majjhima Nikaya. It's usually translated as the monuments to the Dhamma. And it tells the story of one of the famous persons in the time of the Buddha, King Pasenadi of Kosala, who lived in Sawati, just outside the Jeta Grove Monastery where the Buddha spent such a lot of time. And in this sutta, the king goes to visit the Buddha. And as soon as he goes to visit the Buddha, he says how much he enjoys going to the Jeta Grove Monastery. Why? Because the monks are always smiling and happy. And the Buddha said, yes, great king, that's how it is when you have success in meditation. When you gain insights into the Dhamma, you get happy. So you can always tell how a person's meditation is going by the contours of their mouth. If the edges are going down, you realize, no good. If they're horizontal, it's still no good. If the corners are up, that's good. Their meditation's going well. You see, if people get into these deep meditations, they still smile on their face. And I can look at them and say, yeah, they're having a good time. It's nature. That's what happens. So you can put forth that fun and joy in your meditation. Any other questions anyone has? Okay, let's stop talking about it. Let's stop thinking about it and let's do it. The night is still young. The rain is pittering-pattering down, just like the rain's retreats when all the monks and the nuns put forth that beautiful effort. In that beautiful rain, you can't hear the sound of the traffic. You can't even hear the sound of your thinking. All you hear is this rain dropping, dropping. Stillness and peacefulness, like being in the jungle, a long way away from anywhere, in seclusion, in peace. Great time to develop jhana. So, this could be your night. Give it a try anyway. Okay, good night everybody. Someone left a key in there, that's the key to what? Sorry? Oh, well, yeah, okay. Oh, that's what the guy left, 50. Okay, do you still want to sit outside this evening? It's raining. Jeffrey? We'll do it tomorrow then. Okay, very good, okay. So by the way, if you do want to leave early, you don't get any money back. So you might as well stick it out just for the sake of getting your money's worth. But you can get more than your money's worth. You can just get into these deep states of meditation. Okay, so off you go. Enjoy the moment.